Picture this. You show up for work, and before you do anything else, before you check the weather, before you look at charts, you sit down and breathe pure oxygen for an hour. Not because something is wrong, because something might go wrong later. 85,000 feet later at 3 times the speed of sound. I'm Tower on ATIS Radio Hangar's Daily Aviation News. Today we're going somewhere most pilots in history have never gone. Not geographically, but in terms of preparation. We're talking about what it actually took to fly the SR-71 Blackbird. Today's ATIS is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. The SR-71 was the fastest air-breathing aircraft ever to see operational service. Designed and built by Lockheed's Skunk Works program in the 1960s, it was a product of one of the most secretive and capable engineering teams in aviation history. The aircraft cruised above 85,000 feet and held a top speed that officially exceeded Mach 3.2. Unofficially, the crews knew it could go faster than the books showed. You don't publish your ceiling when your aircraft is a reconnaissance platform and your adversaries are buying missiles. But the aircraft itself is only part of this story. The bigger story is what the pilots had to do before they ever touched the cockpit. Let's start with the pressure suit. At 85,000 feet, the atmosphere is so thin it barely sustains combustion, let alone human life. Standard aviation oxygen masks and pressurized cockpits have limits. If something catastrophic happened to cockpit pressure at that altitude, a seal failure, a bird strike, any number of scenarios. The crew had seconds, not minutes, seconds. The solution was the same one the space program was developing simultaneously. A full pressure suit, completely sealed, pressurized independently from the cockpit. If the cockpit lost pressure, the suit maintained a survivable environment around the pilot's body. The David Clark Company, a Massachusetts manufacturer with deep roots in high-altitude suit development, built the suits used by SR-71 crews. These were not off-the-shelf items. Each suit was custom fitted to the individual pilot who would wear it. Measurements, adjustments, fittings, refittings. The process resembled having a piece of critical technical equipment tailored to your body more than it resembled any kind of standard uniform procurement. And getting into the suit wasn't something a pilot did alone. Every SR-71 crew had a dedicated life support technician, sometimes called a physiological support technician, sometimes just the suit tech. This person's job was to help the pilot suit up, seal every connection, verify every seal, pressurize the suit, check for leaks, and ensure the pilot's life support system was fully functional before the pilot ever left the building. The suit-up process could take an hour by itself. That's before the pre-breathing. That's before the aircraft is even involved. Now here is where the SR-71 experience diverges completely from anything in conventional aviation. Before every mission, pilots pre-breathed 100% pure oxygen for approximately 1 hour. The reason is called denitrogenation. When you breathe normal air, your blood is saturated with dissolved nitrogen. About 78% of air is nitrogen, and your body absorbs it continuously. At sea level, that dissolved nitrogen stays dissolved. It's harmless. But drop the surrounding pressure suddenly the way you would in a rapid decompression at extreme altitude, and that dissolved nitrogen comes out of solution as gas bubbles in your bloodstream and tissue. That is decompression sickness. The bends, the same condition that can kill a scuba diver who surfaces too fast. At 85,000 feet, it is not a theoretical risk. It is an engineering constraint you solve before you ever start the engines. Pre-breathing, pure oxygen floods your system with O2 and gradually displaces the dissolved nitrogen. After an hour of breathing pure oxygen, your decompression risk drops dramatically. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration uses the same protocol before spacewalks. The astronaut community and the SR-71 community developed this practice in parallel because they were solving the exact same physiological problem in the same era. There was also the matter of diet. Before SR-71 missions, crews had specific dietary restrictions that started the day before the flight. No carbonated beverages. Nothing likely to produce gas in the digestive system. This sounds almost trivial until you think about the physics. At altitude, atmospheric pressure drops. Any gas trapped in the body expands. The same principle that makes your ears pop on a commercial airliner gets amplified dramatically at extreme altitude. For a pilot sealed in a pressure suit at the edge of space, abdominal discomfort is not an inconvenience. It is a genuine physiological distraction at a moment when distraction can cascade into disaster. The pre-flight started at the dinner table the night before. So by the time an SR-71 crew reached the aircraft, they had already spent the better part of their day on preparation that had nothing to do with charts, weather, or nav equipment. They were the system being checked, not just the aircraft. That is an important distinction. Most of us think of pre-flight as something we do to the aircraft. Walk around, fuel check, control surface check, avionics up. We are checking external systems. The SR-71 forced a different frame. The pilot's body was mission-critical hardware that required its own pre-flight. And that frame, once established, informed everything about how the program trained its crews. The altitude chamber was a regular part of SR-71 crew training, not a one-time orientation. Crews returned to it periodically throughout their assignment to the aircraft. The purpose was to teach them, under controlled conditions, what it felt like to become hypoxic, because hypoxia impairs judgment before it impairs awareness. The insidious thing about oxygen deprivation is that it feels fine until it doesn't. Altitude chamber training exists to give pilots experiential knowledge of their own symptoms, what their personal early warning signs look like, so they can recognize trouble before it takes their judgment away. At 85,000 feet on a classified reconnaissance mission, you do not get a second chance to figure out what is happening to you. The aircraft itself imposed its own set of complexities on the ground. The SR-71 leaked fuel before every flight. I want to say that clearly because it surprises people. The aircraft was designed to leak. The airframe was built primarily from titanium, about 93% titanium by weight. Because at Mach 3 cruise, skin temperatures exceeded 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Aluminum structures soften and fail at those temperatures. Titanium held, but titanium expands significantly when it heats. The fuel tanks were designed with expansion gaps that allowed the airframe to grow at operating temperature without buckling. On the ground, cold, those gaps were open. Fuel dripped, ground crews knew to expect it. The aircraft would take on minimum fuel for takeoff, climb to altitude, and immediately rendezvous with a tanker, because only at altitude and speed did the airframe heat enough to seal the tanks. Every SR-71 mission began with an aerial refueling. Not halfway through, right at the start. The crew was already in pressure suits, already denitrogenated, already airborne in an aircraft whose skin was beginning to heat toward operational temperature, and they were connecting to a Boeing KC-135 tanker. The speed matching required for that refueling was remarkable. The KC-135 at its fastest, the SR-71 at its slowest, and those envelopes overlapped narrowly. Boom operators who flew those tanker missions described the Blackbird as unlike any other receiver they had worked with. There was an urgency to it, even at slow speed. You could feel the aircraft wanting to accelerate away. Starting the SR-71 was its own specialized procedure with its own specialized chemistry. The aircraft used a fuel called JP-7, designed for extreme thermal stability. It wouldn't vaporize or auto-ignite from the heat the Mach 3 airframe generated. That stability was a survival requirement. But it also meant JP-7 was very difficult to ignite intentionally. Standard aviation igniters couldn't do it. The solution was a compound called triethyl borane, or TEB. It ignites spontaneously on contact with air and burns hot enough to light JP-7. The SR-71's Pratt & Whitney J-58 engines, massive, purpose-built propulsion systems that functioned as both turbojets and ramjets, depending on speed, required TEB injection at start. Each aircraft carried a limited supply. The SR-71 could only be started a fixed number of times before the TEB supply was exhausted. That was a real operational constraint that crews and ground teams tracked carefully. The start cart on the flight line for an SR-71 was itself extraordinary. It used a pair of modified Buick Wildcat V8 engines to generate enough power to spin up the J-58s for start. The sound of that cart running is something everyone who heard it apparently remembered for the rest of their lives. The combination of specialized fuel, specialized ignition chemistry, and completely purpose-built ground equipment meant that operating a Blackbird was not just a flight operation. It was an entire ecosystem of unique support that had to move with the aircraft wherever it went. The crew flying all of this was a two-person team. A pilot in the front cockpit, and a reconnaissance systems officer, the RSO, in the rear. The RSO operated the cameras and sensors that were the point of the whole enterprise. Both crew members wore full pressure suits. Both went through identical denitrogenation protocols. Both were trained to the same physiological standards. The aircraft had two people in it, and both of them were mission-critical systems. The ejection seats on the SR-71 deserve mention, because the situation there was sobering. At Mach 3, ejecting is survivable only within a narrow envelope. The wind blast at that speed is lethal. Crews were trained to slow the aircraft as much as possible before ejecting, which created a grim calculus in any emergency. You needed the aircraft under enough control to decelerate before you could safely leave it. You couldn't simply punch out of a bad situation. You had to fly your way toward a survivable ejection speed first, if the aircraft would let you. That reality informed the depth of systems knowledge expected of every SR-71 crew. You understood the aircraft completely because understanding it completely was the difference between surviving a malfunction and not. The culture of the program reflected that. These were not pilots who knew enough to fly the aircraft in normal conditions. They knew enough to manage it in abnormal conditions where the margin was measured in seconds. Fewer than 100 pilots flew the SR-71 over the entire life of the program. Against the hundreds of thousands of rated pilots in the United States alone, 100 is a number that stops you. The aircraft served from its first flight in 1964 through its final NASA research flights in 1999, 35 years across which no SR-71 was ever shot down, ever intercepted, ever forced to land by a hostile power. Part of that record belongs to the aircraft's performance. When an adversary fired a missile at an SR-71, the standard crew response was not evasive maneuvering, it was acceleration. The Blackbird simply flew faster until the missile ran out of energy chasing it. That is a remarkable tactical position. Your threat response is a straight line at higher speed. But part of that record belongs to the preparation, the physiological protocols, the suit discipline, the diet, the altitude chamber training, the checklist culture. Every piece of that ecosystem worked, and it worked consistently across decades of classified operations over denied territory. Here's what I want to leave you with, because this has an application beyond the SR-71, specifically, the pre-flight for a Cessna 172 and the pre-flight for an SR-71 are separated by decades of technology at about 80,000 feet of altitude. But they are animated by the same principle. The pilot is part of the system. What you ate, how you slept, whether your oxygen saturation is where it needs to be. These are all pre-flight items for the human component of the aircraft. The SR-71 just made that explicit in a way that most aviation never has to. The 100 pilots who flew the Blackbird weren't just aviators, they were mission-critical hardware in a sealed suit, prepared as carefully as any component of the aircraft they flew. The aircraft set the standard, and the standard was astronaut level. That is a different way to think about what it means to be ready to fly. And honestly, it is not a bad frame for any of us. Sources today include reporting from Simple Flying on SR-71 crew preparation and historical records from the United States Air Force and Lockheed Skunk Works program. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Tower Blue, side up.